This is Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today's show, A System in Crisis. This is a live show. I'm joined in the studio by Ralph Schoenman. Welcome, Ralph.
Thank you, Bonnie. Good to be with you again.
Ralph, you know, there's been an awful lot in the newspapers lately about the disaster in Iraq and the feelings that the whole situation is a catastrophe. People among the ruling class are speaking out about this. At a luncheon sponsored by the New America Foundation, which actually is aligned with the right wing of the Democratic Party, two former national security advisors, Republican Brent Scowcroft and Democrat Zbigniew Brzezinski, made dire warnings about the prospects for Iraq and the overall recklessness of the Bush administration's foreign policy. This from the World Socialist website by Patrick Martin. Scowcroft told his audience of prominent journalists and foreign policy experts drawn from various Washington think tanks that the Bush administration's unilateralism and arrogance were alienating former allies in Europe and the Middle East. U.S. foreign policy was failing to address the implications of the globalization of the world economy, which made it impossible for a single power, even one like the United States with unchallenged military superiority, to simply dictate to the world. Iraq was the focal point of conflict, he said, adding, with Iraq we clearly have a tiger by the tail, and the elections are turning out to be less about a promising transformation, and it has a great potential for deepening the conflict. Indeed, we may be seeing an incipient civil war at the present time. You know, presently, Brent Scowcroft was President George Bush's foreign intelligence advisory board, and he has been let go. I've been reading an awful lot about the fact that any disagreement or dissenting views within the administration are not tolerated, and he has now departed the administration.
Well, Bonnie, actually, it's interesting here. Of course, Brent Scowcroft, as the national security advisor for George Bush Sr., was one of the architects of the Gulf War. And indeed, one of the people who had planned, along with his boss, George Bush Sr., the ensnaring of Saddam Hussein. They had set him up earlier. Interestingly enough, Brzezinski was the person who had organized that. I'm speaking now of the immediate aftermath of the Iranian Revolution, when Carter was the president and Brzezinski was his national security advisor. And there was a meeting in Kuwait at the time between Zbigniew Brzezinski, King Fahd of Saudi Arabia, Emir al-Saba of Kuwait, and Saddam Hussein, in which Saddam Hussein was instructed to invade Iran and to amputate or detach the oil-producing province of Iran, Khuzestan, which happened to have 6 million Arab minority citizens. The multicultural nature of Iran, as in most societies, not just to the, in the Middle East, but in our own and in all cultures and societies, there are ethnic and religious differentiations amongst the population. The calculations of Brzezinski and of the U.S. rulers of the day under the Democratic President Carter was that the Iraqi citizens of Khuzestan would welcome an invading army from Iraq because of the Arab nature of Iraq. And it is the case that, of course, the Shah had persecuted the Arab minority and the Khomeini regime had continued in that with its governor, Admiral Madani. But here is the point. Saddam Hussein invaded Iran on the instructions of the United States and its feudal allies in the region, in order to do to Iran what had been done to Iraq by the British and Americans when they had amputated Kuwait, to detach that oil-producing province and the sea outlet, port outlet for Mesopotamia at the time. And, of course, they miscalculated because in Iraq, the most politicized sector of the Iranian working class, I should say, in Iran, was the Arab oil worker population of Khuzestan. They were in the Tudeh Party, the Communist Party of Iran, and in the Nationalist Party of Mossadegh, and they defended the revolution. They understood exactly what the purpose of that invasion was. Now, over 1 million lives lost in a terrible slaughter, in which Kissinger said, let's bleed them both white. And you had a situation at the time in which the U.S. was arming Saddam Hussein along with all of the subordinate feudal regimes of the Emirates, Saudi Arabia and Kuwait and what have you, Dubai and so on, Abu Dhabi, funding and arming the Iraqi invasion of Iran. Now the U.S. through Israel is aiding Khomeini and Iran in resistance to Iraq, and over a million dead and decimation of both societies. And while this is going on, Bonnie, this leads up to what Brzezinski and Scowcroft are talking about in this most recent forum. While that's going on, the emir of Kuwait moves his artificial boundaries about 900 square kilometers north until they're sitting on the edge of the largest oil fields in southern Iraq, the Rumaila oil fields. And now the emir of Kuwait, who had at the time about $2.8 trillion in U.S. and European banks, talk about flight capital, this 200-person feudal family is almost $3 trillion in U.S. banks. And he had bought Capital Cities, which owned ABC Television, and so on. You see, I think, how the structure of power works in these things with a ruling class. Here's where I'm going with this. The sitting on top of the Rumaila oil reserve, having moved this boundary north while Iraq and Iran are engaged in this terrible internecine conflict, leads the emir of Kuwait to buy the Santa Fe Drilling Corporation in Alhambra, California, for its horizontal or slant drilling equipment. They paid $2.3 billion for that. Who do you think were the directors of the Santa Fe Drilling Corporation? Well, it was Brent Scowcroft, the National Security Advisor of Bush Sr., and Robert Mossbacher, his Secretary of Commerce. Now, the emir of Kuwait, having paid off Scowcroft, or paid his dues to Scowcroft, I should say, gets the slant drilling equipment, and they suck about $14 billion of Iraqi oil out from under the border, and infuriating Saddam, who goes to OPEC and to Baker, James Baker, Secretary of State at the time, and to King Fahd, and he said, look, here we have spent our treasure and our blood defending the stability of the Emirates against the radicalization that followed upon the Iranian Revolution with aspirations across Shiite populated Emirates for transformation, for social change, for national ownership of the means, the oil production and such. And this Iraqi invasion that the U.S. set in motion was through their continued backing of Saddam, he was their man in Baghdad for 27 years, was intended to serve U.S. imperial interests in the region. Now, what they do is the following. They go to Saddam. King Fahd did it. James Baker did it and said, you've been done wrong. Why, those wicked Kuwaitis have gone and taken part of Iraqi territory and now they're taking your oil. You should rectify your border. Baker sends him a communique. George Bush sends a communique. April Glasby, the U.S. ambassador, passes a memorandum to Saddam Hussein saying the U.S. will understand if it rectifies its recently breached border with Kuwait. James Baker arranges an appearance between the Democratic head of the House Appropriations Committee, Lee Hamilton asks Baker, well, does the U.S. have any interest in this dispute over the boundary with Kuwait and Iraq? He says, none whatsoever, giving Saddam the green light. Saddam mobilizes about 40,000 troops to rectify that border on Kuwait. The U.S. prepares for the Gulf War. They had their casus belli. Now, what's interesting about all that is that Mr. Brzezinski writes a book called The Grand Chessboard, in which he cites these entrapments and ensnarements as preparatory to a U.S. design for the capture of Caspian Sea oil in the Central Asian republics of the then Soviet Union, and as well to destabilize the Soviet Union as a global power. They fund a series of so-called terror groups or insurgent groups, Islamic insurgent groups, and they give a man named Osama bin Laden $6 billion along with Gulbuddin Hekmatyar, To destabilize Afghanistan, where the Soviet Union had been drawn in, what Brzezinski called a bear trap. So I mention all this, Bonnie, as background to elucidate what are the real issues here when a James Baker and a Brzezinski and a Scowcroft and a Colin Powell and former Shinseki, the head of the army and the chief, and Shalikashvili, the former Clinton chief of staff of the armed forces, joint chiefs of staff, chair, start making noises about the illicit and misguided policy in Iraq. What are we dealing with here? Because these criminals, and that's what they are the architects of all of this. So what we're looking at here is divisions within the rulers amongst about tactics, about the most efficient and effective way to accomplish these aims. Here's what, interestingly enough, in that important forum that you cited, here's what Brzezinski told us. He said, you know, if we want to sustain a U.S. occupation of Iraq with U.S. military forces there, we have to stop this fantasy talk, this hype about how victory is ours and the and all that. He says, here's what we need to do. We need to have 500,000 troops in Iraq, and we have to spend about $200 billion a year for the next decade. That's just, he says, for starters, to sustain an occupation of Iraq. And in that very forum, Stephen Clemens, of the Rockefeller, president of the Rockefeller Brothers Fund, says to Brzezinski, are you recommending that? And Brzezinski laughs. He said, no, I'm describing what it really means. So yes, the scoundrels are having a falling out, but what is that about? It's about an insurgency. It's about the fact that 200,000 people are now acknowledged to be part of the insurgency and the national resistance in Iraq. It's about the fact that they cannot sustain this bloody occupation, without, the casualties that they try to conceal. They acknowledge 10,000 wounded amongst American troops alone. It's the tip of the iceberg. They've sent over 15,000 U.S. wounded just through one hospital in Germany. So, yes, they are now saying to each other, we need surrogates to do this for us. The old game of having country-selling regimes in place, like we had in Iraq for those 27 years. That's how they went about installing the CIA asset Saddam Hussein in the first place in Baghdad. So I think we have to be careful here, Bonnie. Yes, it's absolutely clear that the ruling class is in disarray and is divided over how to best to proceed. There's a important segment of the rulers, including Bush's father, who are saying, hey, you know, we did this the first time. We had our man in Baghdad. We tamed him. We disciplined him. We had the conditions in which to get all we needed out of him. He doesn't want to drink the oil. He doesn't want to swim in it. He just wants his cut. That's how we do business anyway. Don't get greedy, brothers. We don't have to have the whole pie. We can share a little with these hired hands, is the stratagem that these guys are articulating now. Now they say, how do we extricate? What do we do to stabilize a another client regime in that terribly afflicted, besieged, and destroyed country, Iraq? That's what this is about.
You know, Ralph, Zbigniew Brzezinski also went on to say that not only would the Iraq situation require 500,000 troops and $200 billion a year, but it would also require a draft and new taxation on the American public to pay for this, and he pointed out that the American public are not prepared to do this. But, you know, the fact that these guys are alarmed themselves about what is happening is truly alarming. And then, of course, there's all of this talk about Iran, and we've all been hearing, we've all, by this time, I would suppose, have read the New Yorker article by Seymour Hersh.
Mm-hmm.
And his sources, who say that some special forces are already on the ground in Iran. I don't know, Ralph, if you watched any of the Condoleezza Rice confirmation hearings. That's been going on for a day and a half.
I have.
Joe Biden was referring to Seymour Hersh's article about, well, of course, we've ourselves talked at length about how the, there's been posturing about bombing nuclear facilities in Iran. Joe Biden made an interesting comment this morning. He said that he was on a commuter train ride with former CIA director George Tenet, and Tenet pointed out that there couldn't possibly be a repeat of, say, do you remember the Israeli bombing of the Osirik nuclear facilities in Iraq a few decades ago? That could not happen now because in Iran, their nuclear power plants, their nuclear facilities have all been built underground and scattered around the country. So it's not even possible to bomb a specific site above ground. And so then that makes you wonder, well, what is the plan? If they're going to attack Iran, as so many people have pointed out, they don't have the troops to do it, and there's no single facility to bomb. So what are they talking about?
Well, Bonnie, the permanent war scenario that was the entire ideological rationale for the aftermath of 9/11 and the contrivance of 9/11, as the BBC in its three-part report so recently, in a remarkable documentary called The Power of Nightmares, which is a within a very conventional and bourgeois framework, let's be clear, but nonetheless, The Power of Nightmares sets out to show that this entire claim of a terror apparatus is a fiction. And it talks about the invention of an enemy afar to create a panic and rationale for the long-determined policies of seizing the resources of that region. It's a three-part elaborated documentary, which now, what is it, 3 years after you and I have been doing this kind of talking and broadcasting and documenting and establishing and clarifying about the nature of the ruling class, the 2% that owns 90% of the national wealth. I should say 1% because it's actually now only 1%. It has over 95% of the assets, more than the combined wealth of 95% of the population in the hands of 1%. They have to create myths, and they have to sustain contrivances and what we call false flag operations in order to sell to the American public and impose upon us the class war at home, no less than that afar. The question of Iran goes to the issue of the United States' determination to have command over all of the resources of the region. And in 1953, the CIA and the U.S. rulers overthrew the government of Iran, of the nationalist leader Mossadegh, when he nationalized oil. And they installed the Shah of Iran. The son of a syphilitic corporal of the British Army who had massacred the various minority populations of Iran on behalf of the British as they were colonizing that country. Well, his son, the Shah's son, was installed by the CIA in 53, the Mossad of the Israelis and the U.S. intelligence agency set up the secret police, the Savak, to torture and disappear the opponents of U.S. rule, the supporters of the nationalist movement of Mossadegh, the supporters of the Tudeh Party, and so on. This is a long-standing affair. And when the revolution in Iran occurred in 1978, which we were discussing before, Khomeini came to power, in a sense, hijacked that revolution, which is a larger discussion. The American government immediately began to do was prepare for the next round in Iran, and all wings of the ruling class have had that objective. What they quarrel about and what they differ about is how to accomplish this. Bonnie, before we talk a second about Iran, I just want to mention a cover story in Newsweek 2 weeks ago called The El Salvador Option. Because what you have here is the real face of Brzezinski and Scowcroft when they challenge the Bush current policy of decimating Iraq and having a direct American occupation. You know what the El Salvador option is death squads. And on the front cover of Newsweek is an open discussion about how the United States has to return to what it calls the El Salvador option, the way they did all over Central America and Latin America, which is to run death squads, and what they're doing right now in Colombia, what they did in Argentina, what they did in Brazil, what they did in Guatemala and Honduras and El Salvador and in Somoza's Nicaragua, to run death squads. They want to run them in Iraq. They want to use covert ops and special forces to carry out assassinations and wholesale eliminations of population, sectors of the population that oppose and resist U.S. rule, as an alternative to having this 150,000 occupying army. And as, of course, the absurd predicate of this is that they're going to combine this with an indigenous Iraqi force that will do their killing for them. The Iraqization, like the Vietnamization of the conflict, accompanied by U.S. death squads. That's what the subtext is of the divisions within ruling class when Brzezinski and Scowcroft are attacking the current policy of dependent upon U.S. troops to carry out this suppression of the Iraqi population. They are looking to substitute for that Iraqi forces with U.S. killer squads as they did in Indochina and across Central and Latin America. I think that it's no less an illusion. By the way, Bonnie, there was an interesting a letter that was in the San Francisco Chronicle, I think it was on the 16th, in which the letter writer noted that both George Bush and John Ashcroft and Donald Rumsfeld had and then Condoleezza Rice had on various occasions stated that you're either with us or against us, and that those who oppose what we are doing in defense of freedom are in fact aiding the terrorists. So the letter writer asks, since James Baker and Scowcroft are no longer in favor of the policy, and obviously on the basis of what Ashcroft and Rumsfeld and Bush have said, are thereby objectively aiding the terrorists, he said, well, I think it's only fair and appropriate now that they should be subjected to torture. Because after all, that's what the presumptive Attorney General next, Mr. Gonzalez, had openly called for. And so has Tom Ridge, the former director of Homeland Security. He has stated that the restrictions on torture should no longer be adhered to. In fact, openly stated that it was necessary to allow and to approve torture for those who are trying to destroy America. So the letter writer, or it's a marvelous little letter, former Secretary of State James Baker has expressed opinions on the war in Iraq at variance with the House party line, so has former National Security Advisor Brent Scowcroft. The Bush administration has proclaimed Iraq the front line in the war on terrorism. The administration has also, when it comes to the war on terrorism, stated, you are with us or you are with the terrorists. Bush's First Attorney General John Ashcroft asserted that dissent against this administration helps the terrorists. Does this mean that Baker and Scowcroft are now with the terrorists? If so, shouldn't President Bush have them tortured? While he's at it, shouldn't the president order the rounding up of known associates of these terrorists, including the former boss of Baker and Scowcroft, who was the first President Bush? Maybe George W. Bush can't find Osama bin Laden, but I'll bet he can find Baker's old boss in Kennebunkport, Maine. The sooner these threats to national security are silenced, the better. There's always room for a few more at Guantanamo Bay, the letter writer concludes. Well, I think we can call this gallows humor, Bonnie, because what they're talking about is the torture at random of opponents of policy anywhere in the world.
Well, there was an article, Ralph, in the front page of the New York Times today that says that Gonzalez, who's going to be the new head of justice, wants the CIA exempted, that has exempted the CIA from any sort of restrictions on torture.
In fact, Bonnie, the Guardian in London ran a remarkable article for its documentation, and it's just irrefutable. A global gulag to hide the war on terror's dirty secrets. Bush is planning to build jails abroad to hold suspects for life. And what is disclosed is that the Bush administration, with the support of Congress and the leading Democrats in Congress, bear in mind, you mentioned Joe Biden before. When Gonzalez was appearing before the confirmation committee, Joe Biden said, "I love you, I love you, I love you, Mr. Gonzalez." I think Mr. Bush is perhaps influenced by this declaration in his relaxation of his call for a constitutional amendment against same-sex marriage. But leaving the expressions of Joe Biden for Mr. Gonzalez aside, the gravamen here is the Democrats are on board for the entire criminalization of the American state that is reflected in its embrace of torture. They quote the lawyer Alan Dershowitz as saying, "Well, you see, if we use needles under the nails, but the needles are sterilized, that would be admissible and acceptable. If we bury them alive, as long as we don't intend them to die, that is admissible. If they are subjected to the waterboard treatment, I mean, it is something that the most morbid satirist wouldn't have attempted because it would be considered too broad."
Ralph, it's horrifying beyond belief, because they've redefined the definition of torture to only include severe organ damage and death. So that leaves a lot that is not considered torture. You're listening to Guns and Butter. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I'm joined in the studio today by Ralph Schoenman. Ralph is the author of Iraq and Kuwait,
The History Suppressed.
History Suppressed, The Hidden History of Zionism. What else, Ralph?
Death and Pillage in the Congo, A Study of Western Rule. Homage to Palestine, Prisoners of Israel, together with Maya Schoen, and various other things, Bonnie.
Well, I wanted to let all of our listeners know, Ralph, that this Saturday night on January 22nd, you and Maya Schoen will be speaking at a fundraiser that in Sonoma County, actually in Santa Rosa at the Sonoma County Fairgrounds. It's a fundraiser for the Middle East Children's Alliance and also for Guns and Butter. And you're going to be speaking on the events of 9/11, correct?
We're going to discuss the false flag nature of 9/11. And, Bonnie, we're going to focus in particular on something that's just been surfaced once again in the Los Angeles Times, namely the inevitability of a biological attack on the United States, one that will require the imposition of vaccines and the quarantining of vast numbers of people and the virtual martial law state. As you know, as we've discussed so often over the past year, almost every other week, a mainstream publication was talking about not if but when there would be such a thing. And now the Los Angeles Times is relating this to the success of the insurgency in Iraq. The insurgency in Iraq and the fact that the population is supporting it will lead, it says, inevitably to a biological attack within the United States. This is a, once again, setting. Sorry, Bonnie.
Well, Ralph, while you're having a drink of water, I want to give the address of that event. I think that speeches start at 7 p.m., but actually the event starts at 3 p.m. There'll be many bands, many activities. That is going to be at 1350 Bennett Valley Road, and that's in Santa Rosa. That's Highway 12 East off of 101. It's the Garrett Building. It's on the Sonoma County Fairgrounds. It's going to be quite a wild event, I understand.
The Whirling Dervishes and many bands and musical groups, and it's a kind of festival, Bonnie, I gather, and with a a very large attendance, and I think they're expecting over 1,000 people at the fairgrounds.
Well, I'll believe that when I see it.
Yeah, well, you know, from their lips to God's ears, we say. but in any event, it is going to be a broad-based event, and in the evening, Maya and I are addressing this question of the false flag nature of the so-called war on terror. We'll be developing some of the evidence that the power of nightmares has cited, apart from the overall critique. Barbara Lubin of Middle Eastern Children's Alliance will be addressing the question of Palestine. Dennis Bernstein of Flashpoints will be emceeing the event. You will be making introductions and comments, and I think it's going to be a dynamic event. I hope people will come and that we'll be able to continue to do this critique, this assessment of how power is really structured, the class war at home, the class war abroad. The global gulag that we are discussing here, in a way, we see these things, and we there's a certain banality in the way we see them described in the established press. This is extraordinary. They're intending to set up a global gulag where they can secretly transfer detainees unconvicted by any court, and I'm reading from Jonathan Steele's article, unconvicted by any court for the rest of their lives, beyond the scrutiny of the Red Cross or any other independent observers or lawyers. This is an open, formal policy of torture camps, detention camps, concentration camps in every country of the world, to which political opponents can be sent, having whisked them off the streets in the sort of dirty war that the El Salvador option for Iraq that Newsweek now embraces, and that was, after all, the signature of the Brzezinskis and the Scowcrofts, who oppose aspects of the massive use of U.S. troops in Iraq in the light of the insurgency. That's their option. That's the alternative.
Ralph, now this worldwide gulag where they want to lock people up for a lifetime, they do not even have to charge these people, do they?
No, and look, it's a crime even to disclose that a family member has disappeared. It will be a criminalized, disclosure will be criminalized of the fate of your family members. For us, for you, me, for anybody in this country who is speaking truth to power, for this station, for those who are engaged in a movement of resistance, for trade unionists, for social activists. What do you think was the fate of tens of thousands of people in Argentina and in countries across the world? That's what we're talking about here. What they are doing with impunity in every country in the world, they are now planning to visit upon us here as well. Let us be clear, they specify that this includes citizens of the United States. Citizens of the United States are not immune to this. This is really the embrace of a fascist a response to the crisis of the capitalist system, because it is a system no longer capable of meeting the most elementary needs of human beings. They are waging permanent war. They are engaged in adventures abroad that have no possibility of success, in the sense that their victim populations are compelled to resist on a scale never before experienced by U.S. imperialism. Consequently, the system's criminal character comes to the fore openly and ever more explicitly. All parties who are engaged in defending the established order are compromised and engaged in rationalizing and supporting this. John Kerry, in his questioning of Condoleezza Rice and in his comments, was attacking again, as he did in his campaign, from the right, criticizing for not having created a sufficiently large American force on the ground, attacking for not having thrown enough, quote, resources into the fray. This is the criminal nature of the ruling class, and it speaks to my mind to the fundamental question. Working people in the United States must have their own political instrument. The Million Worker Movement was about that. It's about mobilizing rank-and-file people around our own agenda and in our own name. If we merely try to pick and choose amongst this criminal ruling class and their spokespersons, we will prepare for nothing less than the gulag for all of us. So I think those really are the stakes. It's not hyperbole to say so.
Ralph, I didn't realize that they had already publicly stated that American citizens would be part of this gulag. I didn't realize that.
Yes, because you see, American citizens who are considered to be supportive of the war on terror can have their citizenship stripped from them. It's part of the Patriot Act. It's part of what Gonzalez himself has specifically spoken to. Ridge has embraced this. Yes, the gulag is not just for foreigners. No, the gulag is for all of us. And
I realize the reality of that. I did not realize. I see where you're going, though, because that's right. They have said that they could strip you of your citizenship if you were accused or found a party to terrorism. They don't even talk about human rights anymore, do they? There used to be a lot of talk of other countries being held accountable or sanctioned for human rights violations. Do you hear about that anymore?
Well, they trot it out occasionally to demonize their former employees, as they have done with Saddam Hussein. By the way, one of the in relation to that, it's interesting that the attorney for Saddam Hussein has brought forth evidence to show that the claim that the Saddam Hussein regime had used cyanide gas on the Kurds in Halabja was in fact fabricated. And now the authorities are having to acknowledge that they have the evidence and the witnesses. Of course, since they are able to cite a Defense Intelligence Agency report by Stephen Pelletier, which documented that very fact, it just again illuminates the cynical use of the claims about violations of human rights on the part of the United States, because the U.S. was deeply implicated in those events itself. You know, we were talking earlier, Bonnie, you had brought up the question of Iran, because I think we can't ignore the fact that Atlantic Monthly in December ran a very long piece by James R. Fallows called "Is Iran Next?" And now Seymour Hersh in The New Yorker gives the specific, very long and detailed and well-documented article about the special forces that are operating in Iran right now. And it is clear that the rulers are not intending to stop in Iraq, even though the resistance of the Iraqi people presents them with a tremendous crisis. They are compelled to pursue this policy because the system itself is dependent upon military production in an ever-increasing amounts. The San Francisco Chronicle, by the way, in an important piece on looking at what the financing of all this deficit capitalist structure involves, cited $72 trillion in deficit and in long-term debt. That begins to indicate the magnitude of this crisis for the system. They will attempt to terrorize the population with the call to war. They will profiteer over waste production. The merchants of death will so do. As they do that, they are cutting all social services. They plan to impose a permanent freeze or ban on national public expenditure, except for homeland security and for war, for defense. That means that all of the obligations of the state to its citizens, from health care to education to housing to pensions to the support for the indispensable social services on which people's survival depends, are for the chop. And I again like to emphasize that this is systemic. This is a crisis of the system. And it's not a question of patching it here or modifying it there. It's a system of private ownership of the means of production that is incapable of meeting human needs. Its productive capacities are restricted now to the coercive apparatus of the state and little else. And all wings of this class are in lockstep with this.
Ralph, were you referring to the freezing of funds or the cutting of all of these programs across
both,
the board?
Both. There's a, you, there are across the board. I mean, Schwarzenegger is openly preparing this in California. It's also been in city across city in the United States. They are calling for cuts in support for libraries, cuts in support of social services for the handicapped, for the elderly, for the indigent, for the infirm, for the homeless, cuts in public school funding, cuts in health care, cuts in Medicaid, cuts that go to the very ability of people to survive. The Boston Globe gave us a clear indication as to what this really is about. On January 14th, Brian Sender for the Boston Globe staff, billions eyed to replenish forces. A forthcoming request for additional funds to continue waging war in Iraq does not begin to address the hidden costs of the conflict. According to secret Pentagon reports and governmental authorities who acknowledge that tens of billions of dollars more will be needed to repair and replace the heavily used equipment and to compensate for the wear and tear on the members of the armed services. And then it talks about the $100 billion in supplemental funds to pay for the ongoing combat in Iraq and Afghanistan, which will then bring the total official budgeted amount to over $200 billion as, in fact, but a down payment. They say that there will be another $20 billion over the next 3 years just to be at the same level of preparedness as before the war. And then it speaks again about the impact on the equipment, all of which mean to replace. They're going to double up. There is a 40% increment that they plan for what they call long-term costs for the sustaining of the military. The Army and Marine Corps, the article continues, and the National Guard and Reserve units are burning through the trucks and armored vehicles at a rate 10 times the prior average, according to a confidential briefing prepared by budget analysts and Army officials. As a result, tanks, trucks, aircraft, and other equipment are being destroyed more quickly than anticipated. By some estimates, 40% of the ground equipment has to be replaced. Now, what's interesting about this, as I mentioned, is that the stress on Army equipment and the growing concerns about the impact of the resistance in Iraq on the U.S. Armed Forces has led to calls from members of Congress immediately to increase the size of the Army and the Marine Corps and its funding. Led, the article continues, by Senator John F. Kerry, who had called for adding 40,000 ground troops to the ranks during his failed presidential bid last year, 21 Democratic senators and leaders of the Democratic Party sent a letter to President Bush urging him to set aside additional money in the fiscal 2006 military budget to increase funding for the Army, Air Force, and Marine Corps. Quote, "The United States military is too small for the further missions it faces," the Democratic lawmakers wrote. "Simply put, success in modern war requires sufficient boots on the ground. We have 150,000 troops and Marines in Iraq and 20,000 in Afghanistan and tens of thousands more in Korea and elsewhere, and we're going to need additional soldiers. We are left to conclude that the American military is too small, not ample, for the challenges we face today and for the future challenges which we must meet." 21 leaders of the Democratic Party and John F. Kerry. So I think it's very clear that the two parties, the one big property party with two names, are servants of the corporate military agenda of U.S. rulers and not of the American people. That if we're serious about building a movement to end this war in Iraq, and if we're serious about a fight back, we have to begin to create a political instrument of our own based on working people, based on the trade unions, based on the mass of our population, on the rank and file.
Ralph, when you were reading that article, it mentioned Afghanistan. And one thing I found quite shocking in watching the confirmation hearings of Condoleezza Rice before the Foreign Relations Committee was that every time the subject of Afghanistan popped up, everyone, not just she, but all the different and sundry senators onto the committee would volunteer that, oh, well, I supported that. Oh, well, that was fine. They were all seemed in not only in favor of the invasion of Afghanistan, but how it has all turned out. And there was a bit of talk about the fact that they'd run terrorists out of Afghanistan. But the fact of the matter, isn't it, Ralph, that Afghanistan is now run by warlords, that Karzai is basically the mayor of Kabul, that Afghanistan now produces 87% of the world's opium, and that it's referred to openly as a narco state. And they consider this a success?
Well, it was the narco state that they had initially created. The Northern Alliance, as it's called, which is nothing but a group of warlords that were sustained by the Central Intelligence Agency and by U.S. imperialism, no less than the Taliban, let it be made clear. I mean, the U.S. set up the Taliban no less than it had Al-Qaeda through the ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Services. Brzezinski, you know, what's one of the interesting things when you read the when they're talking to each other, like at the forum that you cited, at which Scowcroft and Brzezinski were holding forth, there's nothing disguised about it when they're talking to themselves. They lay it all out there. Brzezinski is nothing but candid. He talks about the nature of these groups that they had been funding and how that's who they had to rely on. Now, what you're describing in Afghanistan, which is, I mean, bear in mind, the mayor of Kabul, Mr. Karzai, is a former hired hand of Chevron, of which Condoleezza Rice was a principal director. And not only she, I mean, the chief national security advisor that John Kerry had put forward had been involved, Richard Morningstar, with Chevron and with Condoleezza Rice and in the doings in Afghanistan, no less. It's one. It's a club of the privileged. Yes, Afghanistan, this... What are we really looking at in Afghanistan? You had a period when two Marxist parties had the broad support of the population in Afghanistan and were vying, actually they were divided over the best stratagems for Afghanistan, but they were agreed upon the following: distribute the land amongst the peasants, equal rights for women, and the ending of this feudal warlord control of the peasantry. The emancipation of the peasantry. That's what the policies of Brzezinski and of Carter and the others were designed to destroy. And the agencies of that destruction, the instruments of that destruction, were not only the Taliban and the Al-Qaeda as it became, but also these warlords that they are now using once again to run Afghanistan. And the opium production, interestingly, one of the complaints that they had against the Taliban was that the Taliban, not because they were so much opposed to opium, but because the warlords in the north of the country had greater control over it, they stopped it. And as soon as the Taliban began to cut back on opium, the U.S. targeted them in particular, because, and that's another discussion that we've done on various shows, Bonnie, the control over heroin and of the drug traffic is a growth industry for American, not just the banks, but also for the Drug Enforcement Administration and for the Central Intelligence Agency itself. Gary Webb, who died under what I am convinced are less than clear circumstances. I don't think that one can accept at face value the claim that this man committed suicide. Gary Webb was one of the many of us who had been over decades documenting what Alfred McCoy at the time had called basically the drug policy of the U.S. state. It was the way in which the war in Vietnam was waged. Air America, the CIA proprietary airline, was trafficking in the heroin out of Laos and Cambodia right into the United States. Dick Gregory and I at the time, this is going back to the 60s, exposed that the Air America was packing the bodies of U.S. soldiers, eviscerating them and packing them with heroin, sending the corpses of U.S. dead actually into Idlewild, which became JFK Airport. And there they would be met by defense intelligence, by DEA, and the heroin unpacked from the corpses of US soldiers. If this seems grotesque and outlandish, it's long been exposed and well documented now. And Alfred McCoy in The Politics of Heroin in Southeast Asia lays this and other evidence out as well. And this is the feature of what has happened in F2. Suffering Afghanistan, it is again an expression of the criminal nature of this ruling class in the United States. Drugs are a growth industry for them. They run them into our cities to destabilize the youth and to prevent the politicization of the most victimized sectors of our population. They're targeting the black population in particular, black youth. The Crips and the Bloods and the drugs and the all of this, they are at the door of the Drug Enforcement Administration. It goes to what the nature of the occupation of Afghanistan is really about, as you say. And actually, it does indeed bear upon their plans and ambitions to once again revisit in Iran what they've been doing since 1953, namely destroying any regime or attempting to do so that doesn't submit to U.S. Hegemony. And I think that the abiding lesson that we gained from the Gonzales hearings, from the fallings out amongst the rulers about which way forward in Iraq, from the sudden orchestration in Seymour Hersh's New Yorker and in the front page French story, you know, when you have mainstream publications like the New Yorker and the Atlantic Monthly running Is Iran Next, and you have this surfacing of the fact that there are large-scale operations, special force operations that the United States is carrying out at this very moment in Iran, that the Israelis are deeply involved with this, which is an old story, and you have both sides of the aisle. You have Boxer, Senator Boxer, who was given some press play because she was challenging Condoleezza Rice over the issue of weapons of mass destruction. All the while, by the way, supporting the necessity for the United States to stay in Iraq. It's Boxer who is responsible for the Syria Accountability Act.
That's right.
Which calls for U.S. military intervention in Syria and for the replacement of the regime. So they're arguing about tactics and they're posturing before the American people because, as the polls now show, something like 56% of the American people want an immediate end to this occupation in Iraq. That's probably an understatement, because I think we have to bear in mind that what we find with our population here is that they are not allowed to have real choices. And in the absence of real choices, when it's just two wings of the same criminal group who are presenting them with what appears to be an alternative, for the most part, people turn off. They feel helpless. They feel that it's not anything that offers something that shows a way out for them. And they become depoliticized as a consequence. That's the intent. But in truth, when people have the opportunity to see an alternative, they rush to it. And without any doubt, the population in this country understands that this war in Iraq is a calamity, that the body bags are coming home, that the rulers lie to them day in and day out, that they can't trust them any farther than they can throw them, and that the interests of the country are not identical to what they hear out of Washington and the established press.
That's what was so glaringly apparent in watching the confirmation hearings of Condoleezza Rice. There were a few senators, of course, including Barbara Boxer, as you've pointed out, who questioned Condoleezza Rice about certain falsehoods that she had put forward to justify this invasion, the weapons of mass destruction, the aluminum tubes, etc., etc., etc. But there was never any underlying question of U.S. imperialism itself. That's always left out of the discussion.
Well, yes, but Boxer's upset with the Bush administration because the Bush administration, from the framework of Boxer, didn't basically let the Saddam Hussein apparatus implement U.S. policy as it had for 27 prior years. They're questioning the rationale for substituting U.S. forces for surrogates. But the policy, and it's interesting to see how Condoleezza Rice responded. I don't mean the posturing about her love for the truth, these people use the language to deprive it of any content. I mean, the word truth in coming out of their mouths bears no relation to anything. The Condoleezza Rice, with a straight face, said to the 9/11 Commission that the Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden had been carrying out the bombings of the World Trade Center in 1993, when they are the authors of that, as they themselves have been obliged to acknowledge, with the FBI having staged that as a sting operation, and the New York Times, Los Angeles Times, the Village Voice, all replete with the evidence of that. So truth in their mouths means absolutely nothing. What did Condoleezza Rice say? Well, you know, we must stay there, because otherwise the Shiites and the Sunni and the Kurds will go at each other. And, you know, what she was basically telling us is it's the white man's burden, said Condoleezza Rice in Iraq. U.S. imperialism is needed to keep these primitive peoples who've only recently dropped from the trees from carving each other up. Well, the tragic, of course, truth is that the Iraqi people have been a united people in struggle over decades. The revolution in 1958, even under the British colonial rule of Nuri as-Said and King Faisal, there were no divisions across ethnic and religious lines. It was, in fact, the Mossad's Oded Yinon, as we describe in the Hidden History of Zionism, with his document, A Strategy for the 1980s, that called upon the U.S. and Israel to fragment each of these countries along ethnic and religious lines and to overcome the national cohesion that a sense of national purpose and of national self-determination and of national pride and national ownership of the means of production and national ownership over their resources and an anti-colonial movement that bridged all ethnic and religious affiliations would achieve. Just a personal note on that, Bonnie. In 1967, my colleague and friend Khalid Ahmed Zaki, who is the president of the Iraqi Student Association in London and was a Turkoman Sunni from Iraq, because of the brutality of the regime that the U.S. had imposed after the CIA putsch that overthrew Abdulkarim Qasim, with Saddam Hussein as torturer-in-chief on behalf of the CIA, Khalid organized a national uprising. We arranged, he and his people were trained and instructed in Cuba. I was dealing with Fidel and in touch with him at that time. Khalid, and here's the point, organized the Shia Marsh Arabs of the South, the Kurds led by Talabani, and the Sunni in a national movement. They liberated 10 prisons in an attempt to regain the national control of their country from the U.S. stooge operation in Baghdad.
You've been listening to A System in Crisis. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. I've been speaking today with Ralph Schoenman. We hope to see you Saturday night. For more information on that event, the fundraiser, go to www.mecaforpeace.com. That's MECAFORPEACE.com. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you, Bonnie. I guess we ran a little bit out of time there, but this La Luta Continua, brothers and sisters. Keep it going.
Everybody look what's going down.
Hey, yo, don't you dare hurt you, Stevie. Kick it to him again one more time.
It's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.